Good morning, everyone, and it's a pleasure always to be able to talk at the Freud Museum, and indeed a privilege. So I'm going to talk to you this morning about a series of broad things relating to the paper that you've just heard about. But let me begin first by saying that psychoanalysis and anthropology are disputatious siblings. They were born at the same historical moment at the end of the 19th century, and their squabbles are legendary. There is perhaps only one area on which they have consistently agreed, and that is the fact that humans are makers and users of symbols. We are all of us born into worlds not of our making, and to thrive and flourish in them, we need to assign and attach meaning to their workings. For the world to be sensible, it has to make sense. However, the existence of this agreement turns out to offer very little comfort. Both psychoanalysis and anthropology, as ways of thinking and doing, are theoretical terrains with their own convoluted internal disagreements. Levi-Strauss's account of symbols as structures of mind or language with universal functioning could not be further, for example, from that of the American anthropologist Clifford Geertz, whose own symbolic anthropology depended on the proposition that man is an animal suspended in webs of significance he himself has spun. I take culture to be those webs, and the analysis of it, to be therefore not an experimental science in search of law, but an interpretive one in search of meaning. It turns out that theories of symbols don't make much sense without other connecting theories, notably those relating to meaning, agency, structures and laws, as well, of course, as theories of mind. Taken together, much of the difficulty here is about how we conceptualize what it is to be human. In the case of psychoanalysis, pre-theoretical assumptions about universal human characteristics have very far-reaching consequences. Are we fundamentally alienated in language? Are we basically object-seeking? Are we propelled by instincts? The answers to these questions result in different accounts of the topography of mind, in different ways of conceptualizing the relationship between social and self-styled aspects of subjectivity, and in reworkings of the relationship between subjects and objects. The problems which various theorists confront are bequeathed to them by earlier generations, Durkheim in the case of Levi-Strauss and Freud in the case of Lacan. And the contortions of theoretical elaboration are further exacerbated by imagined and actual relations with peers whose overdetermined relations are often more redolent of those of siblings, in that they most often proceed either through forms of identification or through determined forms of ignorance. Levi-Strauss, for example, seems to have cared little for Lacan as a contemporary, and neither of them engaged sensibly with Barthes or Foucault or Bourdieu. But then, Paris is a big city. The point being that theorists within psychoanalysis and anthropology invest in and have imaginative engagements with the kinds of selves they construct in their theories. And consequently, such theories relate in complex ways to the historical circumstances of their production, as well as to the individual investments and fantasies of the theorists themselves. With regard to theories of society and self, theoretical development and advancement depends on the very thing it seeks to understand, the relation between the psyche and the social. It could not probably be otherwise. But subjectification is about symbols and laws or regulation. It's formed in a set of dynamic processes that connect sense-making or culture, including our sensate physical engagement with the world, with regulatory constraints about the kind of person one is allowed or required to be, where such constraints involve everything from discourses to actual legislation under law. There is no way to safely or profitably extract the psyche from the social or vice versa. We all come to be selves in social contexts and live in the shadow of history, simply because contexts change. Thus, the self and the subject are always linked to larger scale social and historical processes, which we need to keep in mind. In contemporary society, many ordinary citizens have come to hold theories or accounts of the relationship between the psyche and the social, which are themselves inspired directly and indirectly by anthropology and psychoanalysis. For example, contemporary societies have very specific views about culture and its relationship to identities, rights, and so on. And this, in both cognized and fantasized form, animates our views on such things as the welfare state, immigration, and abortion. These ideas are based on views about the kinds of people we and others are or should be. Psychoanalytic theories, or at least bolderized versions of them, are part of common language. Who has not heard of the Freudian slip? They are the implicit and explicit stuff of novels, narratives, and films, accounting for motivation and providing explanations and self-justifications for all manner of things. However, as more than one witty commentator has remarked, in the self-reflexive, self-aware world we inhabit, it's not just that a generalized knowledge of psychoanalysis infuses popular culture, but that we can now self-identify our symptoms as Freudian, Lacanian, Kleinian, and so on. So that theories of the self have become part of self-making, and the metaphorical cat is most certainly out of the bag. Let us now explore how all this relates or could relate to Levi-Strauss and what we might want to talk about this morning. So the symbolic effectiveness of which Levi-Strauss speaks in his essays on the sorcerer and his magic and the effectiveness of symbols, which has been brilliantly summarized for us just now, thank you for that, is based on the idea that the shaman's song and other related magical activities provide patients with a way of understanding both their problems and the world. His analysis of how a shaman helps a woman give birth depends on understanding that the shaman's story is a coherent one because it is culturally inscribed, and it is efficacious because it corresponds to an underlying reality. The myth, spelled out in the shaman's song, and the underlying reality are similar in structure. And this works because collective belief informs the mythic song, which then provides a psychologically coherent account of a physiological process and allows the woman to give birth. The effectiveness of symbols lies then in what Levi-Strauss calls an inductive property, by which formerly homologous structures built out of different materials at different levels of life, organic processes, unconscious mind, rational thought, are related to one another. Symbols work because they make sense of the world, but also because they are themselves products of underlying structures of thought and language. These structures, as he says, are not only the same for everyone and for all areas to which the function applies, but they are few in number. The world of symbolism is infinitely varied in content, but always limited in its laws. There are many languages, but very few structural laws which are valid for all languages. As he says elsewhere, the myth form takes precedence over the content of the narrative. So for Levi-Strauss, all human productions are the consequences of these laws, which are inherent as structures of the mind. But humans are not conscious of these laws, which are, of course, regulated by the constant work of a logic of differences. Hence, Lacan's debt to Levi-Strauss is a very direct connection. Further, for Levi-Strauss, the symbolic exists in a state of continuity with empirical reality through the workings of the structures of the mind. Consequently, such variability as exists in the content of symbolism is not important. His view of the world is one where the social order is a rational totality emanating from the structures of the mind, and the symbolic is both consistent and complete. So when we think about Levi-Strauss's account, and interestingly that mine is actually differing slightly from the account we've just had, which is what we would expect, Levi-Strauss's account is his pre-theoretical assumptions are, for the symbolic, that it is universal, that it is invariant, that it is complete, and that the content doesn't matter. So nothing is excluded, and ultimately the symbolic will be determining. So this, of course, is one account of how symbols become efficacious, and one account, therefore, of how the psyche relates to the social. But what happens if this is not the case? So let's turn to another ritual about birth to explore an alternative account of the symbolic, one which has some consonance with that of Lacan's reformulation of the symbolic. So the Afar Yangis ritual is a fertility ritual that enacts in sequence the coitus of the divine couple, the loss of virginal blood, conception, gestation, the announcement of the birth of sons, the birth itself, the quest for the mother's breast, and accession to the law of the father. In the long period of preparation that precedes the rite, noise, singing, dancing, the cutting of hair, the building of houses, the collection of certain products, and the use of certain words that recall reproductive processes are all prohibited. Life forces are kept strictly controlled, so that when they are re-released at Yangis, they burst forth with huge power and vitality. The rite lasts for 2 nights and 2 days and comprises essentially a series of spectacular dance performances. Now, Bernard Jouyera's brilliant analysis makes it very plain that it is only possible to understand the shape and narrative of the public rite when it has been linked to myth and other forms of esoteric knowledge. However, contra Lévi-Strauss, such linkages do not form a coherent story. So when they all come together, they don't make one set of sense. Nor do they reveal, all of these things when you put them together, structures of the mind. But what the Yangis ritual does, rather, is to set in motion metaphors, resonances, and associations that allow individuals to move through the narratives that Yangis creates, and therefore through the broader symbolic system of the Afar, in particular ways as they participate within that ritual. Now, what gives Yangis its shape is a series of interconnected themes, not all of which operate on the same analytic level. Now, when I say that, I'm not talking just of the anthropologist or the psychoanalyst interested in this ritual, but for people themselves. They're operating at different analytic levels as they participate. And these interconnected themes are things that you might expect. So the Oedipus complex, the origins of the social order, the emergence of the masculine subject, and the instauration of masculine domination. And through these means, it brings into play a series of affects, representations, and emotions which link the development of the masculine subject to the origins of society. And both are encompassed by the narrative of conception, birth, and social emergence that Yangis narrates. Now, Yangis, in common with many rituals in Papua New Guinea as it happens, enacts the fact that men are keeping knowledge from women, but also that this knowledge was once owned by women before it was stolen from them by men. Men know that this knowledge is not rightfully theirs and that women are genuinely powerful, as opposed to the fragility of their own powers obtained through murder and trickery. In Yangis, men construct an account of male communities producing male children, imaginatively and materially involving themselves in the growth and regeneration of the phallus. However, the Afar have an image of the universe as created from the body of the mother. According to one myth, the primordial mother dies of a hemorrhage whilst giving birth, and her body is dismembered by her divine companion, who uses it to create the universe, and her single central breast is hung in the sky and becomes the sun. This is all given dramatic form in Yangis, which works over an overt theme of relation to the maternal, an underlying tension between a desire for the mother and a return to the imagined world of plenitude and non-separation from her. So in this symbolic system of the Afar, we can see two or three things happening, which are important for understanding the nature of the symbolic. First of all, there are several different versions of how this system actually works. There's no one version of it. There's no one set of interpretation of symbols, and the structures don't work out in one set of ways, partly because people are differentially positioned in relation to them. The second is that unlike various versions of this Lacanian symbolic, the symbolic system of the Afar is a product of the circulation of this contradictory set of desires for the mother, but it's the mother rather than the father that is the generative principle of Afar society. And it's the impossibility of relations with her that acts as the objects of desire and sets in motion the magnificent rituals of Afar culture. But it would be quite incorrect to say that a desire for mother-child unity produces Yafar culture directly. Because it is, of course, strictly speaking, it's negative. It's the failure on which it's founded. So Yafar society is patriarchal and male-dominated. Women are rigorously excluded from male knowledge, and sexual relations between women and men are subject to considerable constraint. We cannot, therefore, speak of a society built on repressing the mother or on the repression of desire for the mother. The subject's relation to desire is much more elliptical. Desire is something unrealizable, but beyond that, it's not necessarily committed at all to realization. In other words, we cannot understand desire as that which would seek to be realized if the law did not exist. So that if the world were a different place, men would actually desire to be reunited with their mothers in a pre-social plenitude. The masculine, and indeed the social, emerges out of the split with the mother. Thus the subject is split from its desire in Lacanian terms. And this makes the subject dependent upon the negation of its own desire for its existence. So desire is an impossibility and remains unrealized as a condition of social existence. So here the functioning of the symbolic, when taken alongside the functioning of desire, is not about the determination of the social or the psychological through the functioning of the symbolic. It's actually rather the reverse of that. So contra Levi-Strauss, culture or the social cannot be figured as the straightforward realization of underlying symbolic structures, but rather as the product of their impossibility or failure. What the Yafar material suggests is that the particular way in which each culture slips and slides around symbolization provides it with a distinctive shape, as both Lacan and then later interpretations by Zizek suggest. My point, though, is desire is always socialized in a specific historical form. It doesn't act in the abstract. As Castoriadis famously argued, society's representations make no sense outside their engagement with specific forms of subjectivity. Culture or the social is not produced by the symbolic in the sense of being a realization of it, but is then the consequence rather of subjects' engagement both with the symbolic and the social, and of how those relations are set up in fantasy. Now we know this is the case at a very simple level because symbolic structures do not in themselves account for how people live out their relation to themselves, to others, or to their social and cultural contexts, important though they are. So a very simple example here would be marriage rules or the structure of kinship systems, much beloved of anthropologists. We all know that marriage rules have very little to do with actual marriages and even less to do with the experience of actually being married. So one of these things then is what Lacan took from Levi-Strauss, unfortunately in my view, was a notion of an invariant symbolic order. Now, what was good about Lacan in relation to Levi-Strauss was that we have to deal with issues of fantasy and desire, which are not there in Levi-Strauss. Now, the problem we have with Lacan then is how socialized is the desire that is now being discussed. How historical is it? So, he does, you know, if we just take some very basic principles, he begins with the idea, Lacan that is, that desire constitutes the subject but is not concerned with reward or social approval. And he says, relations between human beings are really established before one gets to the domain of consciousness. It is desire that achieves the primitive structuration of the human world, desire as unconscious. So the human subject is in a way always the product of the symbolic order and not its producer. And the desire that is there, structuring that engagement between the social and the psyche, is not, according to Lacan, a social desire. It's an unconscious desire. So let's start then with the last example, and which is on China. And just to say that, let's begin with the idea that in order to understand the relation between the psyche and the social, it's necessary to turn to what forms individuals and their desires. Now, it's straightforward enough to acknowledge that we are shaped by desire and imaginary identifications in ways that we cannot wholly know. But equally important is the way that both fantasy and desire are key to social and cultural institutions, to their production and reproduction in specific social and historical contexts. And for this we could look at Peter Sangren's work on the Chinese family, because it's a case in point. His argument is that Chinese patrilineage imagines a world in which a particular subject position, the filial son, is the epicenter, in fact, the producer of the world. When Sangren refers to Chinese patrilineage, he intends not only a specific set of social structures, such as descent, family dynamics, and generational and gender-based roles, but also ancestor worship, symbolism, cosmology, ethnobiology, gender ideologies, and political institutions. Now, Chinese ancestor worship and imperial ritual both define productive agency as residing in this figure of the filial son, in the sense that it is his actions that make the world. In ancestor worship, the son who makes the sacrifice produces the image of the transcendent ancestor or father figure as the guarantor of the son's own social authority. But what appears initially as an act of abject subordination to a transcendent father figure is in fact an assertion of worldly power by the son. The son simultaneously legitimizes himself through a complex maneuver of presenting his dependence on an imagined father figure, who is conveniently dead, while claiming his own role as a producer of domestic order. So it's through a ritual that a fantasized transcendent power is imagined and transformed into socially effective forms in relation to real-world subordinates, i.e. wives and children. By means of ritual objection to an imagined ancestor, sons assume their status as patriarchs. And this filial action becomes the means of instituting both Chinese patrilineage and its family forms, and does so through materializing the effects of fantasy, making a fantasized relation the building blocks of a social institution. So it is the action of the filial son that produces this fantasized father figure, who through ritual, as I have said, confers his authority upon the son to act in his name. Consequently, the omnipotence of the son as patriarch is actually self-produced. The structure and functioning of this family ideology recruits, of course, the sentiments of gratefulness and filial love into a moral system that demands subordinates suppress their desires and subordinate them to the desires of their real-world patriarchal superiors. But the key point is that it is through filial action in the role of sons that Chinese patriarchs produce themselves as socially empowered. This has the effect of underscoring the appeal of patrilineage's fantasy as self-productive omnipotence. However, in reality, people in general, and perhaps patriarchs in particular, are not the sole authors or producers of their own being and place in the world. This fact is most immediately and unavoidably present in childbirth. The fantasy of male autoproduction speaks not so much to the determination of the psyche by the symbolic, but to what Zizek has termed the ideological fantasy effect in social reality itself, the way that desires are engaged by social institutions and produce social institutions. This process of engagement is subject, of course, not only to individual fantasies and desires, but also to larger processes of social, economic, and historical change. It's not therefore as a dynamic process, one that is determined by the symbolic, but rather one that is engaged with the imaginaries and identifications of the moment, and therefore subject to considerable historical change. What Chinese sons and daughters confront is a cultural fantasy, a patriarchal imaginary, rather than a more abstract or universally constructed symbolic order. And cultural imaginaries are mutable. They're not preordained by universal structures of the mind or the subject's entry into the symbolic, nor indeed by the law of the father. Now, Judith Butler's critique of aspects of this kind of theorizing hinges on the kind of point that I began with. So she says, the very description of the symbolic as an intractable or determining law takes place within a fantasy of the law itself, a fantasy of law as insurpassable authority. Lacan and Lévi-Strauss, in their different ways, therefore both analyze, identify, and, if you like, symptomize this fantasy. Their own theories fantasize and their own theories fantasize a form of transcendentalism akin to that which they actually attribute to the symbolic itself. Now, we all have a tendency to misread our historically constituted social realities and our fantasies as ineluctable and eternal verities of the human, the world, and nature. What's interesting at this historical moment, as we stand talking about these matters today, is that at this time we are not, as perhaps Lévi-Strauss was in the 1940s, and indeed Lacan right up to the end of his life, not so interested now in describing the human condition as we are in improving it. And no doubt this is partly to do with the historical moment we find ourselves in, that which is under considerable challenge. So when we turn to look at our own theories now, we find that our theories emphasize history and mutability as opposed to emphasizing transcendence and universalism. And that, of course, is our fantasy. Thank you very much.
I have a question which perhaps relates only tangentially to what you say, but which struck me very strongly when I reread Lévi-Strauss's article on my way here, which is that the comparison between the psychoanalyst and the shaman makes a lot of sense in that context. And the shaman is clearly a healer, and the psychoanalyst is clearly a healer. But I was comparing it with African contexts that I'm more familiar with as an anthropologist, where traditional medicine is considerably more ambiguous, where the figure of the witch and the anti-witch or witch doctor are not straightforwardly healers by any means. And that relates to that. That would put a very different picture on the position of the psychoanalyst. And I wondered if you had anything to say about that.
I just have lost a microphone. I don't know if I can
hear
at the back.
I feel like a pop star, but anyway. Yeah, I mean, so from that point of view, what I would say is that it does matter what the content of the symbolism is. Yeah?
Right.
That's the first point. Secondly, that these things are not a question of the symbolic determining social imaginaries or indeed social institutions. And you know, I mean, Lévi-Strauss did move backwards and forwards on that position quite a lot. But one of the difficulties that he had is that over in another area of his work to do with kinship analysis and so on, you know, when asked, well, what do you do about, you know, the individuals and their intentions and motivations and so on in structuralist analysis, he said, well, individuals are very important, but actually for the purposes of analysis, we have to methodologically bracket them out, right? Now, it's this problem about methodologically bracketing out people's own intentions, motivations, desires, and how those result in social institutions, which I've been talking about this morning. And so I think you would expect, you will know as an anthropologist that when you look across symbolic and ritual analysis across the world, that there are many cultures which are scholastic in their approach to these matters. In other words, they are written cultures. They have written these things down. They have had people doing exegesis for hundreds of years on them. They know everything that is to be known. They've reformulated them a lot of times. So they could actually be psychoanalysis, essentially, you know, or anthropology itself. Whereas there are other cultures which deal with symbolic systems which are much more partial, much more fleeting. Not just because they're not written in written form, but because they are intentionally so. And I think there's enormous variation in regard to the functioning of the symbolic, if you like, across cultures, as well as to the content of symbolism. I think this is everyone being terrorized into silence by anthropological detail, which can happen. I should have cut down on the detail a bit. Was that, there was a question here and one at the back. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure I fully followed everything, so this may not be a relevant question, but given what you were just saying about the content, I wasn't sure how much... And I missed the complete first example as well. But you used the specific example of Chinese patriarchy to elaborate the kind of fluidity of desire, I think, kind of. And I wasn't sure whether the example was necessary for your point. I mean, could you have made the same point with the other example to show the difference of theoretical? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, probably. I mean, the point, I think, was that... I was making an assumption that some of you in the room might be aficionados of the theories of Lacan, so that therefore you would follow without me having to go into it in great detail that one version is an account of a society that where the symbolic order is organized around the maternal, and another one around the filial son, right? Mm-hmm. So therefore the question of how the organizing point of symbolic orders is different, and I just didn't bring that out for you, but that was the trajectory of the talk.
I find your paper very rich, and I just kind of stopping at sentence, every sentence, and then you were following on with more rich content. So one thing I wanted to ask you just now, you said that there are symbolic systems that are much more fleeting. I'm not an anthropologist, I'm a psychotherapist, so I'm very interested in the area. Could you give some examples of that? Please.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the body of work in anthropology, you will see that most often when anthropologists want to give a very detailed account of something, they will either go to the Amazon or they'll go to Papua New Guinea. And there's a reason for that, because these cultures do, at the level of rational thought and cognition, actually articulate theories of subject formation. As well, of course, as being involved in them at an unconscious level. And because of that, it's much easier to see that process happening. And particularly in the case of the Yafar, I mean, this is a very small group of people. So that's one thing that's also very important is where the Yafar are and how big they are. They're very, very small in number. But in terms of their actual theories of the world, they actually articulate in myth and in thought and in discussion the challenge that the emergence of the masculine subject provides for the origin of the social. Well, we don't get much of that in London, at least not on a regular basis, right? And of course, as we now all live in larger societies, which are much more diverse, we can't expect them to have this single symbolic form. And not just because they're multicultural, but because diversity becomes the functioning of those societies in a sense. You could argue that in the contemporary situation we're in, that the inability to agree on certain kinds of basic understandings is fundamentally undermining society. Like, you know, what is the notion of a good, of the good? Or, you know, what is a good self? You know, so as the pressure of the ego ideal comes on the ego ideal, if those things cannot be solved in certain kinds of ways, if there can be no agreement, consensus around them, then there are all sorts of pressures. So there are lots of societies that don't including the one that I've spent 35 years working in, that really do not go into the detail of the emergence of the masculine subject and the origin of the social. You know, it's just like we're not thinking about that. We've not elaborated a theory of it. We have a theory of something else, but we're not interested in that. So that's what I meant.
Question here, but you ended your paper by saying that the our current fantasy is that we've had the fantasy of the symbolic, as it were, and that our current fantasy is the fantasy of the historically determined, of the transient. Mm. Is the critique of that fantasy underway? And if so, what is it, and what's the next fantasy coming along, as it were?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I wish I knew what the next fantasy was. But funnily enough, at another gathering about 10 days ago, which was on the relationship between anthropology and psychoanalysis, I was talking much more directly than I've been able to talk today about the relationship between desire and ethics, in other words, which is another way of looking at the relation between the psyche and the social, and pointing out, just as I've done partially in answer to the previous question, that there is something of a crisis now in how we understand the kind of constraints that operate on the psyche or should operate on the psyche. So one of the things that interests me is to go back to civilization and its discontents, and back to Freud's original formulation that both civilization and, of course, human sexuality require something to be given up. They require a substitution, right? And more and more, one of the difficulties we have is that people are not willing, or under certain circumstances in the global north, shall we say, to limit forms of satisfaction. And what happens there is that as that refusal to limit forms of satisfaction takes hold, what you have is in the absence of any kind of coherent fantasy or radical politics would do for me, but any coherent radical politics, you have the ego ideal is very, very fragile. So you have extreme expression of rage. So you get a lot of rage against others, against migrants, against people who may impinge on your ability, on your satisfactions, and on the way in which you project your satisfactions into the future. I think we've all felt that moment very, very vividly. So I do think that the historical historical mutability of these things is important. But I think also to understand what comes next is quite crucial. So if anybody has any ideas, please send them on the back of a postcard.
Thank you. You referred to the world situation in the 1940s as a context for both Lacan and Levi-Strauss. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on how you see that, because my understanding is that there's the concept of, as it were, the universal mind.
Yeah.
Was developed in a context of anti-racism. And the idea of a universal humanity. Why have we lost that? And
thank you very much. I think it connects a little bit to the last two answers. I mean, I think that quite a lot has been written about the importance, for example, of actual conflict in influencing Freud's writing. So Civilization is Discontent, very much written in the aftermath of the bloody conclusion of the First World War. And I think coming through to the later 40s and 50s, that was also a moment of high colonialism, and that after the Second World War. And that moment of high colonialism produced a kind of reverse critique, if you like, of which Levi-Strauss was a part. So, you can argue, it has been argued by various people, that Tristropique is either a critique of colonialism or an instantiation of it, and this is the kind of as I said, convoluted internal disagreements to which we are all subject. So people in the room may have different views, but essentially what became important at that time was precisely to describe what we all share, to describe a common humanity, because we just nearly obliterated ourselves in Europe twice within a single generation. Then we were running colonialism all over the world. India had just become independent, but otherwise all over the world. In the 50s, we went into a series of bloody wars of colonialism, which we still have not owned up to the actual consequences of. So there were definitely different positions on this, of course, in different disciplines and different sets of people, different groups of people within society at that time. But there were also those who were looking for this common humanity. And it may be that one of the difficulties of the moment, of the contemporary moment we're all living in, is that we've gone through a long period of talking about the importance to all of our societies of diversity and difference without really recognizing or taking on board, particularly psychically, what that means. And so now there is, in a sense, now these societies in Europe are under pressure. There's a sort of return of this not properly thought through process. I think that might be part of the explanation, but it's very, very difficult to make generalizations, I think. And this is something I'm thinking about at the moment, because I feel that what we're living through now ought to be a place and a space where psychoanalysis and anthropology get together quite urgently to try and say something about what's happening.
Can I make an observation?
Yes.
Yeah, what Henrietta has been saying has just made me think about a contemporary example. Henrietta has mentioned a couple of times the question of immigration today and how it's thought about or not thought about culturally. And doesn't the Levi-Strauss article give us one way of understanding some of the inflection of that debate? People didn't seem particularly worried when 50 or 60 people suffocate in a closed lorry. But it's at the moment when an image is elected from all the possible images that resonates with, for Levi-Strauss, symbolic function. In other words, the Christian narrative. It's at the moment that an image is taken of a parent holding a dead child in their arms. In other words, a modern version of a myth. It's at that moment that everyone starts to get upset. So wouldn't that be an example of exactly the process Levi-Strauss is describing, where you need the symbolic myth function in order to provide the what he calls there the coherent narrative that will then allow people to make sense of things?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, the reason why there was a little bit of a difference between the introduction and what I actually said is because in the writings of Levi-Strauss, taken across this range, as you understand, we can be on this side, which is about how the symbolic function works, which I think is correct, and we can be on the other side about how determining is the symbolic, which I think is a different kind of argument. And of course, he not so much in this chapter that we're all discussing today, the effectiveness of symbols, but in other work, he hardens his position quite a lot on that. And I think the issue here is also about universal structures of the mind, which has been something that's always worried me. It could well be that this is a discussion that we could profitably pursue with all sorts of interesting other interlocutors like neuroscientists and so on. But the thing about the structures of the mind, I'm not so sure about, because that the mythic dimension of mother and child and the Christian story and the expulsion from heaven and all of those different kinds of elements are also in a way things that we actually live in our lives, and so actually we create the myth out of the sensate experience of having lived that kinship link. So it goes both ways, if you see what I mean.
Why does it go both ways? Because when you say out of the experience of the kinship link, doesn't that presuppose a symbolic registration?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a very good example of the discussion between anthropology and psychoanalysis, because what it hinges on is this question of where we're prepared to draw the line on regard to the universal. So, I mean, this is the issue. You know, some of you anthropologists in the room will know that I, you know, wrote a long and no doubt fairly tedious book about how the symbolic is actually historically variable. Yeah. So we're taking different positions on this. I mean, I think my view on this has always been that to say that the symbolic processes are essential for subjectivity, to say that that certain things need to happen, is not the same thing as saying the symbolic always and everywhere has to be historically invariant.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Henrietta, your own work teaches psychoanalysis something that psychoanalysis often tends to forget, which is about the kind of pre-structuring of the symbolic, that there isn't a kind of concrete sensorial reality that functions as a base of symbols, for example.
Yeah, that's true, and I think that particularly because quite a lot of the work I've done on rethinking what the maternal and the paternal are, right? And in fact, for there, you might easily look at someone like Laplanche rather than like Lacan to get some kind of inspiration, because I think that there are, it's certainly the case that, you know, we're born into worlds we don't make, that those worlds are constructed by other people's fantasies, that the paternal and the maternal in them are not invariant. They vary. I mean, anthropologically, they vary. But also, once you are in that situation, you tend to see that cultures themselves maintain, if you look at a ritual over a whole long period of analysis of it, you will see that part of the ritual deals with what you might call the Oedipal crisis. Part of it deals with what I would call the pre-Oedipal, which is about sensate. And beyond that, other parts of it deal with sort of post-Oedipal. In other words, what societies do when they are outside the other side of the Oedipal crisis. Because in many societies, once people have actually gone through that process and had their children and so on, they move quite explicitly into a situation where gender difference, for example, sexual difference, disappears essentially, or is downplayed substantially. So there are all kinds of different sort of parts of time trajectories, which you have to look at things across time within particular cultural contexts as well. And some societies focus on one bit of it more than the other. That's the other thing as well. Particular societies emphasize different kinds of things as being important. But for me, I think what's important is the variability of the way those things are developed, not the fact that it's about the form content argument. It's about the structure versus the content.
Is there one last question before we stop for the break? All right, thank you so much, Henrietta, for a wonderful talk.